Hi, this is ETF.com's Exchange Traded Fridays podcast, a weekly podcast covering developments in the ETF industry. My name is Sumeet Roy, and I'm senior analyst for ETF.com. This week, we're talking with John Champaglia, Chief Executive Officer at Sprott Asset Management. John, great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me back.
Absolutely. So, John, I want to start off by talking about uranium, because this has been arguably the hottest commodity of the past year, past few years, aside from maybe cocoa. But most people don't know much about uranium other than it has something to do with nuclear power. Can you enlighten us? What is uranium and why has its price gone up so much?
Yeah, sure. Uranium, I think, is captured a lot of interest. A lot of investors around the globe, everyone from individual investors right up to very sophisticated institutions, have been reaching out and trying to learn about uranium. And quite frankly, for the period from about 2011 to 2020, there was really very little interest or reason to really be interested in uranium, because it was in a very long, protracted bear market. As the result of the price collapsing, as the world was kind of shifting away from nuclear energy. But something's happened in the last 3 years, and that's really a fundamental shift that is really being driven by three things. One, nuclear power produces zero greenhouse gases. And so governments around the world that are committed to different net zero targets and different decarbonization targets are openly admitting that if they phase out their nuclear energy capacity, they have no chance of hitting net zero. So that's kind of thing one. It really helps achieve the decarbonization targets. The second thing that we learned painfully 2 years ago was what happens when you have an energy crisis or energy shock. And obviously 2022 is very challenging for Europe and Asia when it came to energy prices, because the price of oil, natural gas, coal, etc., all went parabolic on the back of the invasion of Ukraine. And it was a real wake-up call. And we really think this can be best described as an energy shock like we experienced in the mid-1970s when OPEC squeezed the oil price. And it really prompted a very material change in energy policy in across the West. And that's when a lot of the nuclear energy capacity was built. The 1970s and 80s is when many of these power stations were built. So governments around the world, because of the energy density of uranium and because of the security of supply that uranium can provide. And what I mean by that is that when you load uranium into a nuclear fuel reactor core, you can essentially run the reactor 365 days, 24/7 for 18 to 24 months until you need to refuel. So because of that, you are not at the mercy of the market if there is a supply shock or disruption or a price shock to the commodity. So it is incredibly resilient, and it's what they call baseload power, which brings me to the third point, which is we've built a lot of renewable energy capacity around the globe over the last 20 years, particularly in places like China, which are building massive amounts of solar and wind capacity. Which is great, because those are obviously zero greenhouse emitting forms of electricity production, but they have an inherent weakness, and that is obviously they're intermittent. So if you're going to add a lot of intermittent power to your electricity grid, you need to have reliable backup baseload power. And that baseload power comes in the form of nuclear energy. So as the world shifts back to nuclear energy because of decarbonization goals, energy security, and I think diversification, and kind of to complement intermittency of renewable energy, we're now going through another renaissance in terms of nuclear energy, which brings us to uranium, because uranium is the fuel required to power all of these power stations. So if you, to put it into context, there's about 430 nuclear power reactors in the world right now. There's about 60 being built right now, with about 23 of those in China alone. And there's over 100 being planned and at various stages of construction. The world basically wants to build a significant amount of incremental capacity. You know, China is clearly the leader in that, but India also is planning to build lots of capacity. What's driving all of this is that the world wants more and needs more electricity. What's driving it? Well, countries in the emerging markets are becoming wealthier. They consume significantly lower amounts of energy per capita than we do in North America, for example. So they want our standards of living, which is more energy intense. But in the West, something I think is an emerging theme that people are starting to understand is as we move to more things like data centers, artificial intelligence, they require huge amounts of incremental electricity. And so new technologies, we believe in the West, are going to drive incremental demand for electricity. And just for some perspective, in the United States, for example, the consumption of electricity in the United States has been completely flat for 15 years. There's been no incremental increase. If you look at some of the major consultants, they are now forecasting growth rates in US electricity demand over the coming years to grow to 3, 4, 5% potentially per annum, specifically because of data centers and AI, which is a really interesting kind of new use case for nuclear energy. So there's a lot of different factors that I think are supporting uranium. The price has basically gone from 30 to as high as $106 at one point earlier in this year. The price has corrected a little bit over the last 4 weeks, and we're now in the low 80s per pound. But that is still a pretty meaningful increase from where we were 3 years ago when the price of uranium was around $30 a pound. That's obviously lifting the uranium mining stocks meaningfully over the last 3 years. It's amongst the best performing equity sectors, and that's obviously attracting a lot of investor interest.
And John, I do want to talk about miners a little bit later, but sticking with that demand story you just told us about sounds very compelling. Could you give us a sense of, how much demand is expected to go up, and can supply keep up with that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the uranium market has actually been operating for several years with a supply deficit, which means the amount of new uranium coming out of the ground falls short of annual requirements of all the existing reactors. And you might say, well, how does the industry function? The answer is that the industry has been working off of legacy inventories and secondary supplies. We believe that era of secondary supplies is basically coming to an end, and that the industry is under a lot of pressure right now to expand production. Just to give you a little bit of context around the numbers. So today, all of those 430 odd reactors I mentioned earlier require about 180 million pounds of uranium every year. Now, with all of the buildouts that I mentioned, 100 plus being planned and 60 under construction, the annual demand for uranium will go from 180 million pounds this year to 300 million pounds in 2040. So that will be the annual requirement in the year 2040. Our current production is only 150 million pounds. So there's a huge opportunity here for the uranium mining industry to basically come back to life after going through a lost decade of no investment, no investor interest, no capital going into the sector. And we're seeing kind of a resuscitation of the industry the last 3 years is as the commodity prices increased from 30 to 60 to 70 to 80 to 100, you're seeing a number of different uranium mining companies who previously had producing mines signal that they're going to resume operations. So we've had a flurry of uranium mining companies in Canada, the United States, Africa, Australia, basically signaling that they will be restarting production of previous producing mines. A number of new mines are finally moving forward, working through environmental permitting. And this is all very beneficial to the uranium mining companies because you've got an asset that's stuck in the ground making no cash. You then bring it back into production at very healthy economic prices again, and the industry is finally coming back to life. So it's a very compelling, I think, long-term supply demand story. It's not going to be solved overnight because of that lost decade of underinvestment. And we don't foresee the market getting back into a supply-demand balance for at least 5, 6 years until new large-scale uranium mines are actually built. So that, I think, is going to allow uranium prices to be higher for longer.
Interesting. And are the uranium miners, it sounds like they're ramping up production, and are the current prices enough to incentivize them to ramp up production enough to meet kind of that, huge amount of demand that you foresee over the coming decades, or do prices have to go even higher?
Yeah, at current prices, we believe that just about every mine that is economic is now viable. We've seen as announcements recently of mines that produced uranium 15 years ago that have made announcements that they're going to be restarting. So I think that's a pretty good sign that just about every deposit in the world, if it still has some meaningful reserves left and decent ore grades, can be viable with uranium at $80, $90, $100 a pound. And this is, this is something that you see in all commodity markets. You need higher commodity prices to stimulate and send signals to incentivize companies to make the investments to either, flex up production or to build new mines. And this is really important because uranium is the key fuel that's required. It cannot be substituted. It cannot be thrifted. And it is currently responsible for almost 20% of all the electricity production in the United States.
That's amazing. So, John, I want to turn to this one trust. It's called the Sprott Uranium Trust. And I've been reading a lot about it. It has $5 billion in physical uranium, if I'm not mistaken. And some people are kind of attributing the run-up in uranium prices to the amount of money that's flowing into this trust. Is there any truth to that?
I think there is some truth to it in the sense that the Uranium Trust in 2021 and 2022 did raise significant amounts of capital and purchased quite a bit of uranium at a time when nobody was really interested in uranium and there was a supply overhang. But I think more meaningfully, the prices moved because utilities are finally starting to buy uranium again. I mentioned earlier about this destocking of inventory cycle that we worked through for 10 odd years in the industry. That cycle is largely done. If you look at the longer term dynamics of the uranium market, what ultimately drives it is the utilities, their contracting cycle, as we like to call it. And if you look at what happened from 2011 to 20, let's say 2022, there was a period there where the amount of uranium purchased by utilities under long-term contract arrangements was significantly less than their operating requirements. And that really pushed the price of uranium down from, $70 odd dollars all the way down to $18, which wasn't economic for just about anybody to produce at. But what we've seen in the last 2 years is that the utilities are looking at the shifts in sentiment, shifts in energy policy back towards nuclear energy, and they're saying, look, our plants are going to be operating for longer, they're going to be profitable, and they've been back in the market buying significant amounts of uranium. Just for some context, last year, utilities globally purchased about 160 million pounds of uranium under long-term supply arrangements. The year before that, it was about 125 million. And so they've really been pushing, the price up as they contract more uranium. So at the end of the day, I think what investors should really focus on is the utility contracting cycle because we think it's the largest determinant of price.
So, John, I want to talk a little bit more about how investors can capitalize on this bullish uranium story. How does something like the Sprott Uranium Trust, which we just touched on, compare to an ETF focused on uranium miners like the Sprott Uranium Miners ETF, ticker symbol URNM? What are all the ways that, investors can play this theme, and what are the pros and cons of each?
Sure. So, we often get asked the question, like, well, how do I get exposed in my portfolio to this thematic? And there's really a few ways. The most popular way I would say has been investing in a vehicle that holds the physical commodity itself. And Sprott does offer a closed-end fund that's domiciled in Canada, but also trades in the US on the OTC market. And that vehicle is just simply accumulates physical uranium, and right now it holds around 63 million pounds of U308. uranium. So it's a closed-end fund. It's trading at a discount to NAV right now. And the way the fund can grow is that if the vehicle is at a premium to the previous day NAV, then it gives us the ability to actually issue units, just like an ETF, through underwriters in the market. And that's how we've been able to raise a couple billion dollars of new capital since the vehicle was launched in 2021. What we find with the physical uranium is that obviously you're just trying to play the spot market. And that fund has been very popular, I would say, with more family offices and institutions. But there are a lot of individual advisors and individual investors in that fund as well. The other way to play the thematic is through the mining companies. And there we've got two different ETFs listed in the US, URNM. And that provides exposure to a cross section of the two largest publicly traded uranium producers. It provides about 18% exposure to vehicles that hold physical uranium. And then it holds a smattering of smaller uranium producers, emerging producers, and exploration companies. So you get kind of a cross section from large to small cap with some physical in there. And then finally, we have another fund, ticker URNJ, which is the junior version, which is really just focused on all of the smaller producers and down and development companies. It doesn't include the two largest producers. It doesn't include any physical uranium. And that obviously will have a very different risk return profile because you're investing in smaller cap stocks. These are less liquid. Many of these companies are pre-production, so they're pre-cash flow, but they do have a lot of operating leverage to higher uranium prices. They have a lot of optionality to higher uranium prices. And it really comes down to, your risk tolerance. How much volatility and liquidity are you comfortable with? Generally, we like to think of the physical commodity as being less volatile than the uranium miners just because of the inherent risks of mining. And there's obviously inherent equity risk, irrespective of what the sector is. But those funds have been very popular with investors for the last 3 years.
And do you think that uranium miners, John, can thrive even if uranium prices stay where they are today, or do they require prices to keep going up?
I think the current pricing environment in both the spot market and the term market, where utilities typically buy uranium under multi-year contractual arrangements, is very healthy right now and is very supportive of the industry getting back to production and basically growing cash flows again.
Gotcha. So, John, we've talked a lot about uranium. I want to turn now to another commodity that's been in the headlines recently, and that's copper. The price of the metal hit close to a one-year high, I think, this week. Can you tell us what the reason for that is?
Yeah, well, last year was a really challenging year for a lot of commodities. And copper did incredibly well on a relative basis. It finished the year about flat, and that might not sound very exciting, but as you know, a lot of industrial metals and battery metals really corrected significantly last year. What is really underpinning the copper price and what we think is going to propel the copper price going forward is that if the world is serious about decarbonizing itself, and that is obviously coming through expansion of renewable energy, greater adoption to electric vehicles, electric vehicle charging. And then there's all these other applications related to technology that I mentioned earlier about AI. We're going to need a significantly larger amount of copper. And there's a really amazing, mind-blowing stat that we recently came across is that if you go back to the beginning of time, and we've been humans have been mining copper for thousands of years. If you go back to the beginning of time, one organization has estimated that we've produced 700 million metric tons of copper over those millennium. If you think about the copper needed to hit net zero by 2050, this organization called Energy Minute estimates that we will need to mine 1.4 billion tons, so 2 times more copper than we've mined, let's say, for the last 5,000 years between now and 2050. It's pretty mind-boggling. And that's because copper is really the backbone of all things related to electrification. If you think about how much copper you need to wire up new solar farms, wind farms, electric vehicle charging. But then there's all kinds of just basic industrial uses. I mean, things like air conditioners. You know, as people in emerging markets become wealthier, guess what? They want an air conditioner. Those things take up lots of copper. So there's just a lot of different applications. If anything to do with moving electrons around, copper is the key metal. If you look at electric vehicles, for example, they require 2.4 times more copper than a traditional internal combustion engine car. So if you think about the growing adoption of electric vehicles, that is going to be a large consumer of copper. If you look at the different supply forecasts by, let's call it Bloomberg New Energy Finance, they are anticipating that between now and 2050, the demand for copper will double. And remember, copper is already a $200 billion a year market. So this is not like a small market like uranium, which is about 15 billion. So to move the needle and the double the value, the double the production of copper is going to require significant investment. I think that's why the price is starting to move. People are foreseeing supply deficits looming. There's some similar parallels with uranium, where we've got a critical mineral, the world wants more of it, and there were many years where the copper price was just kind of meandering around, and there wasn't a lot of investment. On the supply side of the story, most of the copper comes from South America. Chile is the number one producer in the world. Peru is number two. And there are a lot of different countries that produce copper, but what you find is that a lot of the easy copper has been found because we've been mining it for 5,000 years. So it's becoming more challenging to find at large scale high ore grades. And so that means it's becoming more difficult to find, it's becoming more costly to mine. And I think that ultimately is going to help push the price up. Otherwise, we just will not solve the demand, and supply challenge that we have in front of us.
It certainly sounds like there's a really compelling bullish copper story out there, John. Why do you think the price hasn't moved quite yet? I was looking at the chart of copper, and it looks like the current price is the same as it was back in 2006. Have those demand drivers you've talked about not kicked into full gear yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look longer term, a lot of it was being driven by industrial use. Copper is often referred to as Dr. Copper because it gives you kind of it gives you the pulse of the health of the global economy. What we've seen is that last year in particular, while a lot of industrial metals sold off, copper did not. And the reason for that is because, irrespective of weakness in China's real estate market or economy, copper demand was really underpinned by this energy transition that I mentioned. There's just so many different new sources of demand for copper that we think is going to be very supportive of the price. If you look at more recently, the price of copper is starting to really decouple. So, for example, the price of iron, which is very economically sensitive, has fallen by over 10% in the last 6 weeks, yet the price of copper is up around 15%. And this is really reflecting the fact that supplies of copper recently have been hitting some challenges. We've seen some mines that have closed. We've seen some mines that have announced they're going to miss production. Chinese inventories of copper are very low right now. So we think co copper is kind of decoupling from the other industrial metals, and it's really being underpinned by energy transition demand. And also, as I mentioned, we are seeing some challenges short term with copper supply.
What's the best way to invest in copper, John? Is it through copper miner ETFs or something else?
Yeah, well, there's no physical copper ETF in the world yet. There are copper futures funds, and those obviously have some pros and cons related to those. And I would say the most popular way is through copper mining ETFs. And Sprott has two. One that we just recently launched in the last week or so. The ticker is COPP. And then about a year ago, we launched COPJ, which is the junior copper miners. We think the copper miners are really well positioned here, similar to the uranium miners. a higher price is going to support them. A very durable long-term demand profile is going to support them. What we found, though, it's really interesting when you look at the 10 largest by pounds copper miners in the world. Only four of them are actually publicly traded and derive the majority of their revenues from copper. So, for example, you could have a very large producer of copper. I'm going to just pick BHP Group. They produced about 1.2 million tons of copper in 2022. But if you look at BHP as a company, only 27% of their revenue in that year was from copper. So it's not really a pure play copper company. If you think about the world's largest copper company in the world, which is Codelco, it's a state-owned Chilean, it's a state-owned company in Chile. So, you can't invest in that company. So we find that even though copper is a very large market, it's not the easiest to invest in because a lot of these companies are not pure plays. They are not publicly traded because they're state-owned. And what we tried to do in building the index with our partner NASDAQ for COPP was really focusing on companies that derive a majority of their revenue, so that's defined as 50% or more of their revenue from copper. And I'm happy to say that 100% of our constituents in the index either derive a 50% or more of their revenue from copper, or their assets are a majority tied to copper if they're not yet in production. If you compare that to some of the other competitors in the market, what we found surprisingly is that they can be down in like kind of the 60, low 60% exposure to copper because they include a lot of diversified miners that, bring unintended allocations to things like iron ore or met or thermal coal or another metals like nickel.
Well, fantastic, John. We're going to have to leave it there. You gave us a ton of great insight. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me back. It was a great chat.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can find this and all other Exchange Traded Fridays episodes on ETF.com or on any major podcast platform. See you next week.